charge. Okay. We're going to do the same, we're going to do in class a version of the exercise you did for your paper. We're going to compare. Which we're going to compare two networks. We're going to do well. Using the sort of reference model we've been building up here, we're now going to design the phone network and the internet and talk about the difference between them. But before we do that, I want to talk a little bit about views of networks. Right? You've just written something where you've had to pick two networks to compare. And I know from talking to a number of people between class and this class, that at least one tough part of that assignment, maybe in fact the only tough part, was figuring out the right level of detail to operate at. What kind of network are you comparing? Are you comparing all delivery networks, all communications networks? Are you comparing FedEx, UPS? And that choice is really one you're going to face all the time in that network, because there's no obvious answer. It has to be fit to the situation. So let's take last week's sort of in-class conversation about getting a document from here to Fort Hills. Let's diagram it. Right? If I wanted to diagram the delivery of a document from here to Forest Hills via FedEx, what would I draw?
I mean, we know for sure, right? Here's ITP, and here's Forest Hills, so the address in Forest Hills.
What do I draw between those two things?
Probably at least one or two nodes. That's the distribution.
Okay, so tell me how that works. Walk me through it.
Someone comes from someone who does come and picks up the package at LTP, takes it to Central Processing Center.
Central Processing Center, okay. And then?
Then I'm not really sure, it might be going to a separate local center in Queens.
Let's make it up, so that would be a way to do it.
And then from there it's a good destination.
Where is the central processing center of
FedEx?
Memphis, right. I mean, just that doesn't affect the drawing, but FedEx famously started as a business paper in which someone said the way to do a novel distribution network in the U.S. is send every package to one place, manage where the packages go, and then send them all out again, and to do it nationally all at once. And the urban legend is the paper got a B because the idea was impractical. That part only Fred Smith knows, but that was the original idea. So here it's Memphis. Interestingly, if you care about subnets, one of the few places they break that model is New York, because so much New York to New York address traffic goes that they actually process it at a FedEx center in Times Square. They divert the New York to New York traffic in order to keep it from going to Memphis just to come back.
I think they break out a lot, actually. I know there's a separate West Coast.
Is there now a West Coast center as well? Where,
yeah,
where it is?
I know, because in San Francisco you can send stuff to LA like way later than you can send to New York, basically.
Oh, to take advantage of the time there.
Yeah.
So here, Central Processing Center, this one happens to be 42nd Street. Now, let's say I'm going to draw this, say this document we're delivering an email instead. What would we be drawing? So I email the document from here to Forest Hills.
Align into the cloud and align out.
Alright, so why am I doing that? I mean, yes.
That's some number of nodes they can be in.
Right. And so in here it gets routed, right, and then it goes to Forest Hills. Now, what's your experience? Think about your experience of emailing something to someone. The way you think about it, not someone's breaking it out here. What does that feel like? If I had to draw what it felt like to send a piece of email.
It's
one. It feels like this. Right? And in a way, so does it with FedEx.
Right? You don't actually think, oh, I'm sending this package to Memphis, and then I'm going to ask them to send it on to, you know, someplace in Iowa. You feel like I'm sending this to the person who needs it. Right? And the point about those diagrams is neither one is right. Right? In many cases, right, and it's easier to see actually with email, because you know, we have the concept of the FedEx guy, usually a guy, and we have the concept of the FedEx truck in the distribution center. So you can think of a physical package passing through space. But by the time you get to electronic data, right, the degree of abstraction that you have to sort of encapsulate by saying, oh, it, you know, it goes into the cloud and then it comes out of the other, you know, comes out of the other side and goes where it wants, means that the connection socially, right, I send email to my friend, is actually a completely separate network. Right. So networks are built on networks, and very often the simple lines we're drawing between nodes actually encapsulate an enormous degree of complexity. So the choice you always face in thinking about this, let's say I wanted to trace social capital to the network. Social capital is the feeling that I'm doing good things in the social network on the understanding that I'll get good things back, but it's not transactional. I'm not doing you a favor in order to get a favor back. I'm doing something that benefits ITP, and I know that the ITP community is around. Right? When I measure that, the nodes are really people. Right? I'm really watching what people do in the network, how they trade information, how they converse. Right? If I want to trace a particular piece of gossip, I want to trace the actual how did the gossip get from point A to point B, which is something that social capital is built on top of, right? That kind of informal conversational network. Then I'm maybe down to talking about devices. And I can trace whether the gossip went on a phone call, whether it went by email, whether it went by IM, and so forth. And I can start to look at how it went. If I say, well, the gossip was actually instantiated in IM message or email message or whatever, and I want to get down to the level of data, right. Right. Then I could break it out and say this: well, it went from the ITP subnet to the ITS gateway and out to Sprint and so forth. So I can actually pick when I pick the level of thing I care about. What comes along with it is what I consider the nodes. Right. If I consider this the nodes, all of this stuff effectively goes away. Right. It doesn't go away in the real world, but it goes away in my analysis because I say, this is just the thing that connected these two people. So there are router engineers at Cisco who know everything about this and nothing about this. There are sociologists at Berkeley who know everything about this and nothing about that. Neither one is right. The only mistake is applying model A to situation B. So all models are wrong, some models are useful. There's a lot true of networks at all levels of this stack here, and it's a matter of form-fitting what tools you're bringing to the job. The other thing, and this is by convention, but it is something that's almost universal in talking about networks, is there is a notional idea of a stack, right? Groups working through the problem of general-purpose networks in the 50s and 60s needed to break apart the functions. They discovered fairly widely that they had to separate the functions and layer them. The layering is historically called the stack, and notionally, the closer you are to people, the higher you are on the stack, the closer you are to the machines, the lower you are on the stack. So if you hear about people talking about functions that are high in the stack or low in the stack, you either mean closer to user space or closer to router space. Right? The Netscape, Firefox, those applications are very high in the stack. The Cisco router that's moving the web data from the page you just clicked on is low in the stack. And that the number of layers, the layout of the layers varies situation by situation, which we'll talk about in a bit. But that's a general way of conceiving of network function. Put my eraser up. Every level of detail you're breaking out actually destroys under the table. If I decide I'm going to think about gossip, I'm not going to keep either the people or the machines as clearly in mind and so on. And that destruction is necessary to do any clear thinking, but you have to be careful knowing that you're intentionally ignoring some kind of thing. The other thing that is starting to be, we're starting to be able to do, we've got our reference model from the first class, and last week we added addressing, and we also added the problem of routing, which we'll talk about in a minute. But with those things, we're starting to be able to do fairly high-level comparisons. So, we can say, for example, imagine a document delivery network, like the one we were talking about last week, getting something from here to Fort Tails. You can imagine sending it by byte messenger or FedEx. There's a kind of relationship between those two networks. You can imagine the similarities and differences. Now let's assume instead that the job is to get me to Forest Hills. Right? It was more of a transportation network. Bike messenger is to FedEx as cab is to
bus.
Why?
Because bike messenger carries one or maybe two items most, where FedEx carries multiple.
So that's interesting. Right, so it's that's true, but I'm going to argue that that's a second order characteristic based on the deeper similarity between the networks.
Bike messenger's personal, it drops things off, gather up your bus is youthful, pick it up. It might drop your menu just for bus is just.
And it's this, yeah.
So I was going to say scheduled routes.
Oh, that's right. Right. So it's these two operate on a schedule. These two are, you request them directly. But
direct versus like centralized.
This I think it's the direct versus switching that I'm going to argue is the deep characteristic. And a lot of the other things, like you schedule it versus it has a schedule, it carries a few items versus it carries many items, I'm going to argue are are manifestations of the deeper difference, which is that this is a so difference between a direct and a switch connection, right? The bike messenger takes the passage from you, they get on the road, and it's the same bike messenger and the same bike when the package gets delivered, right? The bus, you've got to figure out, well, I'm going to ride the bus to here, I'm going to get off, and then I'm going to get on a cross-town bus, and I'm going to get on the one that goes across the 59th Street Bridge, and then I got to get on the one that goes out to Forest Hills and whatever. So you go the same as the crow flies distance, but the way the network handles it underneath is quite different. And you can start to make this sort of direct versus switch comparison in lots of ways. And notice, right, there's no real difference. Right? Both of these are internal combustion engines. Right? So it's not the mode of transportation, it's really the design of the network that creates the difference between cabs and buses. And that, being able to spot those similarities, figure out which the deep ones are, and then figure out which ones the derived characteristics are, is a big part of this. I want you to be able to do this analysis, because later I want you to be able to either design a network or to debug or alter an existing one you're observing. And again, by that I mean both technological and social. All right. So questions about that as background? Some questions about that? All right. So let's turn our attention to designing the phone network. Last week we added addressing as a problem. What's the key characteristic of an address?
I guess the phone or
anything. And address in networks. What does an address have to be?
Unique,
right. So that's the essential characteristic we care about, uniqueness. As a matter of jargon, what's
central assigner of addresses. What are the advantages in terms of creating an address space to have a central source that assigns addresses?
Repetition is avoided.
What's the word for repetition we actually want?
Collision.
Namespace collisions, right? We want uniqueness because we want to avoid collisions. We want to avoid having two Sonalis in the same namespace. We can either manipulate the names or we can manipulate the namespace. Both strategies are possible. So centralization is a good way of avoiding collision. Downside of a centralized assigning names in a centralized way.
Very large namespace. In one area.
But what's the downside of that?
That everybody that wants the namespace has to get.
Can't scale.
But that's a restating the problem, which is what's the problem if I have to get it from the centralized node? And you said
you can't. You have scaling.
Right, so you have scaling, just unpack this a little bit. What are the scaling issues? Right. Scaling is a blanket thrown over actually a huge number of related but not identical problems. Right. If I'm going to have one issuer, right, of every name in the namespace, what has to be true of that issuer?
It's got to be a table of every single address.
Right, so it's got a large address table. What else?
Well, if you're applying it to like a person, like that person always has to be available, always has to,
right.
I mean,
right.
It has to be a very special
right.
person.
So this doesn't have to be a person. The uptime requirements, the availability requirements are very high. What happens if this node goes away? Everything's broken. And one of the largest centralized namespaces we've seen fail back when it was running at 70 million nodes was Napster. And if the Napster service were ever down, that was it. There was no Napster. Right? There was nothing else would run. So the function that Napster provided, the issuing, and they also actually provided a lookup of the names, meant that you simply could not. The function CIFA, CISA function. The most valuable centralized namespace, dynamic centralized namespace in the world right now. And I say dynamic because the phone system is centralized, but that's the address are issued by country, is the domain name system. And there's a large open area of research on whether or not an attacker could bring down the domain name system. Which would cause the internet to slow. It would not cause it to stop the way the loss of Napster caused it to stop. It's a potential hazard. Put it on. So decentralized. Right. What's the advantage of decentralized issuing of names?
That if one node drops, that the whole thing doesn't fail.
Right. It has to be more robust. Give me an example of decentral, someplace that where names are issued decentral in a decentralized way.
DHCP.
Yeah, DHCP. Good. I was thinking of something a little more social. Where'd your name come from?
My parents.
Your parents, right? So the largest decentralized issuance of names we have is for children, right? There's zero or almost zero coordination. There's some tradition. But there's absolutely nothing to guarantee that people have unique names. And we get namespace collisions all the time as a result. You can see that. So that's the disadvantage of this. It's bad for collisions. Right. There's one strategy, and we talked about this last week, that comes out of this, which is trying to combine a mix of centralization and decentralization. What is it, Frank?
Redundancy of the centralized network?
Redundancy is good, but redundancy is just a way of making defaults a centralization less risky, but it doesn't actually make them go away. Right? If the problem with centralized nodes is a large data set, how do I make that data set smaller but still keep some degree of centralization? There it was. Where? Branch out. Okay. So, if my central node doesn't want to keep track of 100 billion addresses, then I can just make it keep track of 10 addresses. That's not actually 10 billion. Okay. Anybody can keep track of 10 addresses. You can keep track of 10 addresses in your head. Now, each of these nodes only has to keep track of 10 billion addresses. Well, that's still a pretty large number. Now what?
Keep going.
So, and this is the dominant, it's not the only, but it is far and away the dominant strategy in issuing of addresses, which is you have some authority which issues a certain number of top-level names. And then each of those names is responsible for making sure that all the names underneath it are unique. And then its uniqueness is guaranteed by the level above. And there are lots of ways of doing that. IP addresses do it one way, zip codes do it another way, phone numbers do it another way, domain names do it still another way, but the basic strategy is the same, which is encapsulation and delegation. Right? I encapsulate in .com, all .coms must be different from all .edus. Within .com, the .com issuer is responsible for making sure that all the .com addresses are the same, but there may well be an NYU.com that will not clash with NYU.edu, even though the registrars of both .com and .edu don't have to care about that. Right? So it's a way of encapsulating and delegating problems. So now, with that, we have, I think, everything we need to design for. And we started to do this actually in the first class, so I think this will be more of a recap than anything else. We have here a tin can, a piece of string, a tin can, right, and then we've got our first working phone circuit. Right. And I cannot emphasize the degree to which this is a reasonable engineering model of the way the phone works. Right. This is surprisingly close to the functioning of the actual system, which is the can vibrates when the voice goes in. It causes the wire to vibrate. The wire vibrating causes the other can to vibrate, and the voice comes out the other end. Right. Now, it happens that the encoding is not physical over a tense wire. It is electrical. A crystal microphone typically turns the voice into electrical signals. But the idea of a circuit and the idea of the encoding and decoding being embedded in the device for analog acoustic signals is really the design principle of the phone. Everything else is pretty much in detail. So this is great as long as Dave and I can talk to each other. So what do we do when I am against a phone? Right. Then, what do we got to add?
Two
new lines, right? And now D get the phone. Now what happens when D gets the phone?
Three
more lines. So you can see, you know, when I said scale is actually a collection of related problems. One of the problems of scale, and I'll stop drawing the actual thing, is when I have one phone, I have zero connections. When I have two phones, I have only one connection. Three phones is three. Four phones is six. Five is 10. So you can see that the number of supported connections is getting really adverse relative to the number of actual phones I want to deploy. Right? I'm already, with only five phones in the world, I'm already running twice as many connections per phone. Right? And you can actually see that the formula is plus n minus 1. What's that? It's plus n minus 1, which is to say every time you add a new device, you add to the cumulative number all previous devices to the totem. And you can see intuitively why that is. You come into the party, you have to introduce yourself to everybody else. Right? So the limit case for this is when you've got N nodes in a network. You've got N squared minus N over 2 connections. And the only part of that, you will never use this formula. I just put it up here because it's true. You'll never actually be called upon to do a calculation of this. The reason I put it up is the number that could concern us is that. Anything that grows with the square of what you deploy is bad news. Because at some point, in any finite universe, such as, for example, the one we live in, you will run out of ability to deploy that network. So anything that grows with N squared is not good at large scale. So my beautiful phone network, which is already running into trouble when I've got 5 people, I now have to design it differently because I cannot simply redeploy an additional N minus 1 wires for every nth addition to the network. So decentralization, as it turns out, does not work the way I would like it to. Now, what's the alternative to decentralization as a strategy?
Create a
hub. Right. So now I add a switching hub. There's Marie, me, so forth and so on. Right? So I've got N nodes in this network. How many connections do I need? N. This is great. Scales linear. Beautiful. Right. I add one phone. I also add one connection. Life is good. In exactly the same way that we ran in the problem of centralization of the address space. There are deep problems with centralization that manifest themselves in different situations. What are the problems when we're thinking about a phone network that are going to manifest themselves here?
Limited number of phones.
What's that?
Limited number of.
Or put it the other way. Let's say if I want an unlimited number of phones or limited only by the population of the Earth, what's the problem with having the hub in the basement of ITP?
The node distance.
The distance, right. So suddenly I've got my first node over here in Hong Kong. That's a long wire to be stringing underground just to get it to ITP. So then call the second person in Hong Kong. Right? What else? What is the other problem? What are the other problems with the second? If this breaks down, no one can make any phone calls to anyone ever. Right? So that's putting your eggs in one basket. What else?
Reliable switching.
Right. It's just the engineering requirements of this thing. Right? The engineering requirements of a decentralized network are such that if I's phone breaks, we can't talk to I and I can't talk to us, but everybody else is fine. Right? Here, if I's phone breaks, that's also true, but if this node goes down or has any kind of problem, the engineering requirements here are quite extreme. So, what do we do? We find some way to go in between centralization and decentralization. And similarly to the encapsulated system we just discussed with the routing, we're going to build a network and phones. Now, connecting phones that are near each other to a switch that's near them does trigger the engineering problems of long wires. Right? And since phone traffic tends to be geographically encapsulated, which is to say there are many more conversations within New York to other people in New York than there are people within New York to Hong Kong, we can tolerate some number of nodes wired directly to a single switch that just does the translation. Deciding that number is an engineering problem. Plainly, 100 is too few. You can do more than 100. Plainly, 1,000,000 is too many. Right? By the time you're running 1,000,000 wires to a single physical location, you've got to manage the problem. So it's someplace between 1,000 and 100. As it happens, in the actual phone network, it's 10,000, but again, between 1,000 and 100,000 is really the order of magnitude. Right? So now I've got my central office we talked about in week 1. Right? And what's the central office's job, in addition to just hosting all those wires?
Another central office.
Right. Let's ignore the other central office for a moment. Just within a central office, what does the central office have to do?
Route calls.
Has to route calls. And how does it route? What does it need to route?
An address,
right. The central office is responsible for, and in the case of the phone, I'm emphasizing that two functions are different, but in the case of the phone, they're largely the same function. They're largely folded together. It has to have a unique address. For each line that it's responsible for. And it has to be able to say, okay, I can connect from here to there. Once we have more than 10,000 people, or really once we have more people in a geographic area than we can run wires to, we've got to add other central offi, or whatever the plural of office is. Right. And now, what problem have we created for ourselves? We've got to disambiguate not just the individual lines within central offices, but so the central offices themselves have to be connected. They also have to be disambiguated, so then we'll give them each of them their own code. And then once we've filled up a city, lo and behold, actually, let me take this away. Once we've filled up a city, we then do it again, right? And now what do we have to add? I mean, what do we add, given the way the phone system actually works?
Regional office.
It's a regional office, but what is above the level of an exchange? 998 is our exchange, 1882 is Midori's number and area code, right? So now we've got 202. 6, 7, 8, 7, 3, and so on. Same issue. We're back to our theoretical addressing, except you can now see how it plays out in the real world, which is each level is responsible for disambiguating everything below it. So this node is responsible for making sure within 212 that all exchanges are unique. Within any given exchange, they're responsible for making sure that all individual numbers are unique. Within the U.S. as a whole, the system is responsible for making sure that all area codes are unique. And bye-bye, Brooklyn. Up here, at the very conceptual top, is what? What's the conceptual top level of the phone system?
U.S. country code.
Which country code? Not yet. So in our case, it's U.S. country code. So we invented the phone, we get the number one. Over here is England. Right, and within England, they go down the same system. They use a different breakout. Interesting. Right.
I have a question.
Yeah.
There are two different ways these nodes are set up. One is it's radiating.
Right.
Is it actually working both ways, or are you?
No. The reason. So why am I drawing the edges different than the center? Yes. There is a big difference here. Yes, the fact that I'm drawing squares versus stars is expressing that difference. What's the difference?
Because you never call 646. Like you never call like the middle of the tree. You're calling from the leaves to the leaves of the tree.
You can call from the middle of the tree, but
it's centralized to the
what piece of equipment exists in this square that doesn't exist? What is this? What is that dot?
An actual phone.
It's the phone sitting on Midori's desk. Right? So in fact, to emphasize this, I'll make that a different color. Right? These are phones. What's this?
It's a gray box.
It's a gray box sitting someplace on your street. Right?
or it's a 5 ESS switch buried underground somewhere. Oh, I shouldn't make those arguments. Just try to make a distinction. So, there is a kind of responsibility that the blue dots, there's not the orange dots. There's almost no intelligence. In fact, in the classic design of the phone system, there is zero intelligence at the edges. A phone doesn't know about another phone. All a phone knows is, am I getting a plus 5 volt signal or am I getting a plus 30 volt signal? If I'm getting 30 volts, I'm going to ring. If I'm getting 5 volts, I'm just going to hang out and do a dial. Right? The switches, on the other hand, are responsible for actually managing address space. A phone doesn't have to know its own address. Right? When you plug a phone in, it just works because the address is part of the network. Once you get anywhere above the phone, you start to put responsibility for routing into the devices that are in the middle of the network, the hubs and switches. So in the case of exchanges, the exchanges are actually, they actually know about one another in a way. Right? It is analogous to the function in the network we drew on the board in the first class with the three circles. Right? One of these things has to know, oh, this is being routed locally or it's being routed elsewhere. Now, I've drawn it as a square with connected lines because there's a huge amount of complexity I'm encapsulating here. But the basic requirement is that there needs to be some intelligence at the exchange to say, this is to be routed internally within my exchange, or this is to go elsewhere.
Okay, that makes sense. I was thinking more about this little the square thing. Is that if you're drawing it as a 2D thing up to a pyramid, but it's actually more, you know what I'm saying?
Here's what, if I wanted to do it as a Venn diagram, I would say phones, then there is an exchange that holds that particular phone number but overlaps with other exchanges, right?
It would just need, I understand that, but I think with the squares, it'd probably be more dimensional.
Yes, the squares.
You,
not, right. Yeah, you could. Right. You could draw the squares. You could draw the squares at almost any level of complexity you wanted to show the connections between the nodes. I happen to have just shown three, but I think the real key is you don't get to bridge namespaces without going, like, to bridge countries, you have to go all the way up and then all the way down.
Yeah, actually, I have a question there.
Yeah.
How come you have to dial out of a country and then dial in?
Ah, that is such a good question. What is the answer?
So you can't break out the system.
Why? What would be the alternative to doing that? What would be the alternative to breaking out of the system?
Well, I mean, suppose 9-1 is designated India, right?
Is it?
Yeah.
Okay.
But why do I have to do 0-1-1-9-1 and then 8-0?
I don't know. Why do you get to do that?
I don't think
you have to
Let's put them in a positive. Let's say that we never wanted to dial a 9 or a 0-0 when we break out of the system. Let's say we wanted the same number to be the same phone globally. What would we do?
We'd have to make sure that each number was completely unique.
Which they are. We've got this system to do that.
You have to dial all the numbers all the time.
You have to dial all the numbers all the time.
The reason you do that code is so you know that you're expecting X number of the sequence.
So, we have just invented absolute and relative addressing. So, absolute addressing is, give me an ID number.
9180334683.
Is there any breakout in the middle that you know of? Give me the number. 334.
334683.
I'm going to guess that they went with the 7-digit code, which is what the Brits had until they just went to 8 digits because of London.
Yeah.
So I'm going to guess that this is the breakout. That this is a city. This is an exchange, and this is a loan. Right. And Midori. They might have made us a glory. Now those numbers are unique, right? We are guaranteed
that those numbers are unique because the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, guarantees that these numbers uniquely refer to a country. And beneath that level, each country is responsible for maintaining other kinds of unique. If you wanted to never have to dial a 9 to get out, if you never wanted to have to dial 001 or 011, I could never remember, and I always have to call on my mobile what and ask what it is. If you never wanted to do that, you would just use these numbers because they are absolute addresses. In address space terms, these are, you'll sometimes see these referred to as GUIDs, or more rarely, UUIDs, globally unique identifier, universally unique. And that solves your problem, right? Why don't we do this? Why don't we dial all those numbers every time?
Because it's a theoretically less frequent activity.
Not just theoretically, right? It's
a real pain in the ass, too.
You usually dial locally.
Right,
so it's
right.
It's easier to dial.
Oh, you were saying if you were in the exchange, you could dial locally.
Right. So
if you're dialing international, you're always dialing.
Right, but I pick up a phone. It says, plus 5 volts. What does it want to know from you next? What kind of number is it about, right? And you only have numbers, and this is now, this is already the internet design problem, but you only have numbers to express things about numbers, right? There's nothing else, right? There's no secret special button on the phone. There's just numbers. To say things about numbers. So what do we need to express the difference between... So this is an absolute address, right? This is a relative address. And what this says is, or what it used to say before 646 came along, was in the context of the local area code of the country I happen to be in, please dial this number. So I pick up the phone and I start. In fact, what happens if I pick up the phone at NYU and I start dialing? And I'm going to call home. I'm going to call my wife. Pick up the phone, 1718. What does it tell me?
Gets
you an error.
Right. The number you've dialed at NYU is a non-working extension because the phone didn't know that I meant to break up the global namespace. So how do we handle that? What's that?
A number.
And so we need special reserved classes of numbers, which act as headers. And the header pattern is again, not absolutely universal, but it is ubiquitous in managing address spaces. And what we need is a class of headers, in addition to these numbers, that send information about the number. Right. It's not enough to have the number itself, or rather, if you don't want to make people dial whatever it is, 11 digits every time, 11 or 12 digits every time, then I've got to be able to say things like, that number is reserved. Right? If you are running a PBX, so a local telephone exchange, do not make any of your exchanges begin with 9. And if you don't do that, a good thing will happen because we'll treat 9 as special. And we'll treat 9 as break out of the local context and then go up to the global context. Right. It used to be, right, in New York, that if you just dial this number, you get in the door. If you dial this number now, what happens? You just pick up a payphone, put in whatever it is, a dollar now, I don't remember, and dial 9981882, what happens? Why?
Too many numbers.
There are too many numbers. Multiple areas.
Right. When they added 646, they actually broke one level of relative addressing because it was too threatening. We talked about this, I think, a little bit last week or week before. It was too threatening to have 212 mapped to just Manhattan. Right. So when they added 646, they said, all right, now you've got to break out of the system all the way to get to the root level. Right. So the trade-off between relative and absolute addresses is relative addresses means you have to use many fewer numbers to dial the phone, but you then create the header problem, and the header forces the addition of things like 9, 0, 0, 0, 1, 1, and whatever. Right? So those are ontologically distinct from phone numbers in that they're not part of the address space. They're part of communication with the system about the address, followed by the actual number, which is something that specifies the phone number you need. And you can see that working from the top branch down. That number, 12129981882, does two different things. It is the address, it is also the route. Right? The phone system was designed so that the address is actually a set of instructions that expresses the route. And it serves both functions at the same time. So, any questions about... Yeah?
Yeah, what's an example of an address that doesn't also carry information?
Very good question. What is an example of one? Do you use it every day?
Email? Doesn't carry out information.
Right. Email doesn't carry route information. Why not? How does it get routed? What's your email address?
DY233.
Okay. So I throw that into the network. Is there a node called DIDU?
No, there's a domain.
Right. So there's one layer of indirection between the email address and, in fact, even the IP
address.
Two layers of indirection, because even the IP address does not yet specify a route. It specifies delivery instructions. The routers maintain things called routing tables, which say, when I get an IP address of this form, I'm going to hand it along in this way. But there are only unique routes in the phone system. There are non-unique routes in the internet. I'll draw that in a minute. That's the network we're comparing. I will say this. You could see the brittleness, right? The phone network is famously engineered to 5 nines. It's where the phrase comes from. 5 nines means 99.999% uptime, which is roughly 2 minutes of unscheduled downtime a year. Right? It got to that not because this is a good idea. It's in fact quite brittle. It got to that by massive over-engineering. Right? It's exactly what we said about the central address server when we were talking about a notional central address server, which is you simply need to massively over-provision the thing in the middle if you want it to survive. During the 911 attack, there were a boatload of large-scale switches, 5 ESS switches, in the basement of 7 World Trade, and they all melted. Because there were many, many 5 ESS switches sitting next to each other, they had failover, they had redundant backup. What no one had imagined was the building they were in would go away. And the phone system was down. Right? You could not make a phone call in Lorraine. But you could send email. And email, weirdly, goes over the phone lines. Right? The bulk of provisioning of the lines that email goes over is by the same phone companies that couldn't complete a call. Right? So the difference between the address being the route and the address being something that is looked up to be a route was the difference between the fact that the network was up, the internet was up, but the phone network was down with the disappearance of those switches. And we'll talk about that. We'll talk about that. Yes?
I would like you to draw a graph of this network internationally on a smaller scale just to see if it keeps going down or if it keeps exciting because of
that. Sure. Here's Midori's phone. Mm-hmm. It connects to a switch at ITP. Mm-hmm.
I understand this that scale that would have international.
Okay, so then we're in 212. I think this will get up there. Here's one, right? Because there are only 192 countries, so there are questions of does Palestine have its own exchange? Mm-hmm. There's sort of is Western Turkey kind of the Eastern Turkey kind of issue.
but there are around 200 addresses. Because of that, at the top level, each country can effectively keep track of each other. So at the top level, there isn't a central switch. It's peer-to-peer, right, with that web of interconnection. And then when it gets over here to, say, India, it goes back down the chain.
But it's not that each one is a country.
No, in fact, right. It's each node is. Right? I mean, you can imagine division. I drew it topologically. This shape and this shape are identical. Right? So all this is saying is there is a ring of countries whose communication patterns are known to one another. You go up your own national network, across the international network, down another nation's network to another phone.
Clive?
Yes.
Is the dialing of one to get a new area code is just
so weirdly, we experience dialing one as if it were metadata, as if it were a header. But in fact, one is the US. So our experience of dialing one is I want to change area codes, but in fact what it's saying is go up to the national level and then dial back down again. So it's conceptually it feels like a header. In fact, it's country level routing data. It's just that if you're using it in country, it's transparent.
That's interesting because we don't do that within
you don't go up to do 9-1 and then down?
No. We just go like 80.
Oh, actually that's what they do in the UK too, which is that zero is header information inserted into the middle of the number, and you'll see people paren it in UK numbers. So now London, I guess, is Western or Eastern London is prefixed with an A. So you could the way they do it in the US is that you just dial this. You dial the one to get another area code. In the UK, instead of doing that, you dial the zero, which specifies the zero is a piece of header information which stands for in country rather than specifying the area code. And the reason you do that is that four, unlike one, four cannot be a reserve number. Just from the design of the switches, it could have been a reserve number, but it ended up not being. So the design of what is, given you've only got 10 digits to work with, the design of what counts as header information, what counts as address information is tricky. It used to be, in the old days, that all area codes had to be in that form, which is any number followed by a 0 or 1 followed by any number. And that if this was 8, it was special. If it was 9, you couldn't use it. It was 8. So I guess I should say actually it was 1-7. And they ran out. Right? Predictably, the address space still got it. This is a common problem in address spaces. If you design them at any finite number, the designers of the original network think, oh my gosh, 4 billion, we could have 4 billion IP addresses. Who could ever use 4 billion IP addresses? Well, they made that calculation in the late 70s, and now we're paying for it every day. All right.
Okay, I have a question. I'm just curious. Who organized the country code? I mean, who defined the country code?
The country code is a fantastically contentious issue because of things like this Palestine get a country code. There's a group, and the same thing happens with domain names, right? Does Tibet get its own domain name? There's a group called the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, and what they say is we are the unique issuers of country codes. If you have had a successful civil war and you subdivided your country and now you want a new country code, you've got to come to us or you can't plug into the grid. The ITU punts the question of who is a country to the UN. Because if you have this conversation about who is a country every time you need to issue something per country, you all get in politics. So they said basically, it's a true first approximation representation of the UN. The ITU does not run the actual interconnection between nations, it's just servers that are looking at your own country.
So this is the guarantor.
That's
the uniqueness in the addresses. It doesn't actually have to run the network.
So do they decide who gets a 3-digit number and who gets a 2-digit number?
Or does it just go all the way down the list?
Well, it started pretty much sequentially. And as I said, since we invented the phone, the strong arm, so we got number one. But you know, it's almost every naming scheme starts out with some semantics embedded, and they almost all move to just issuing unique integers. So that's if you showed up with the country of D tomorrow, you would presumably get whatever integer is off the end of the current list. There's no other semantics, right? USA, we're number one. There's plainly some semantics in the original,
yeah.
In the original deployment, right?
Is there a country that has the code just number two,
like France is?
No, France is.
Yeah, I mean, if UK is 44.
UK is 44. France is 40. Switzerland's 42.
So there are no other
singles. Ireland's 353.
Right. That's interesting. That's interesting. Right.
You're
right.
972. Yeah.
Chickens,
what's
that? 507.
All lowly beings, I tell you.
Yeah, I think that they. I don't. That's a good question. I don't
what's
know.
Japan?
I will.
81.
They may well have reserved the subsequent one-digit numbers because it's impossible to use them as headers. Right. One is a reserved digit, so if you dial one, the phone is expecting something, or rather, the network is expecting something special. I don't know. I'll check and see.
So after the US, they basically dumped everyone into the 40s upwards.
I'll check and see if there are any other one-digit numbers, and if so, what happened in the 20s and 30s? It may.
No, the 30s are in use. The 20s are in use.
Okay, so maybe they started with 11 or something. No, they couldn't have because one is reserved. So maybe they started with 20.
Okay.
In terms of the email, is there any one-digit code overnight?
Yes, I'm going to do the internet now. So let me back up. Then I'll use email as an example. So I'll walk through the whole stack. Call your attention. Okay. I don't expect anybody to get out of here and go look for a job at running MCI's network. I want to call your attention to larger scale design principles, which are much more important than how the IT handles particular kinds of things. The phone is circuit switched. To a remarkably literal degree, what you were doing when you were making a phone call is you were specifying a route that you would lease on a pair of wires between you and the other end. Up until the early 1990s, that was literally what happened. Electrical switches were closing at every place where an exchange or an area code was happening. Physical relays were closing, making copper wires connect. The phone is analog, and I put that with a big asterisk. The phone system is analog, meaning it is designed to encode analog signals. It was, again, until the 90s, almost literally an analog system. It's now been largely digitally re-implemented, with the exception of the copper that comes from the street, the so-called last mile problem. But even then, what the digital system that they have deployed is doing is it's utterly emulating the analog system they built before. So it's backwards compatibility to the early part of last century.
This is the fiber optic.
Is that anything? Right, they lay all this fantastic fiber optic cable, and what they do then is they emulate copper wire. Right? They have a product called SONET, which is their digital optical networking. And the goal of SONET is to behave as much like copper wire. Yeah.
They do it overseas through satellite, but what?
They do it undersea. They do it through satellite.
Before satellite,
it was all undersea cable. It was all undersea cable, and
they run giant,
and they're just huge boats that look like those Con Ed trucks that are spooling cable in the sea. Except the cable spool is as big as this room, and they would just lay cable, and it literally just sits on the bottom of the ocean. There's an astonishing movie, utterly unrelated to anything having to do with this class, but it's quite remarkable. The tubes are negatively pressurized, they're vacuumed. And at one point they were cutting a tube. tube. They sent a sub down. We're cutting a tube. And a little crab came along and it cut a 16th of an inch slice into the negatively pressurized tube. And the crab, who's about this big, was sucked through a hole this small. And you see this crab just... And it's quite remarkable. So the engineering challenges of doing that are significant. Right? They're unrelated to the network design issue. So with you can Google for crab and telephone or something, or crab and underseas, or crab and vacuum, and you'll see a movie. But back to the design issues. The phone network was designed for the application it runs. Right? It was specifically designed to optimize voice. Right? The address is the route. And that gets an asterisk as well, because we now know with number portability that they've added naming on top of it, which we'll talk a little bit more about in the... talk about the edges are qualitatively different from the center. By which I mean Midori's phone is not a router. Midori's phone is not a switch. Midori's phone is just a phone. A phone is a different kind of device than a switch. Right? So the edges are dumb. And this is really the... Dumb terminal smart network. The design philosophy of the phone is how many functions can we take away from the user and still leave a usable device? Right? And the answer is if you force the user to communicate using numbers, right, to create the header information with first a rotor dot and later a dot pad, everything else can move in the network. The intelligence is in the network. There is something to that. As a function of that, this is a network that tends to succeed or fail. The call goes through or it doesn't. There's not a lot of degradation. It's just it works or it doesn't. So, now, let's say that we don't want to make a phone call. Let's say we want to move a piece of digital data. And we've got, as we actually do, a network. Computers on it. And we've got some connections between those computers. We've got a bunch of connections between those computers. So here we are designing a new network. Call it the internet. That sounds kind of catchy. First characteristic I need those nodes to have.
Each node is
needed.
Addresses.
Start from there. You've always got to be able to disambiguate those where you need anything else. Right? So I'm going to give these nodes unique addresses. Let's say they're all unique. Right? And now I want to move a packet of data from one place to another. Right? So here's my packet. Here's my destination. If I wanted to design this the same as the phone network, right, I'd just give you each of the intermediate routes some numerical designator. I'd make the address be that numerical designator. And then the address would specify the route. And indeed, that's a lot what internet traffic looks like. It looks like sender and receiver are working as fundamental. Those are IP addresses. IP addresses are big endian, as it were, which is to say that the largest part of the namespace is... Oh, yeah. IP addresses, sorry. It's domain names the other way around. IP addresses run in the same direction as phone numbers, which is to say that the biggest chunk of data is in the first of the four quartets. And so all IP addresses are broken up into these little four sections. But the internet doesn't behave like this, right? On 9/11, when all the switches went away, the internet stayed up.
Right? I was in my basement, I couldn't call anybody, I could email people. Right? So, how do they do that? What do they separate? We have to separate in order. What can the address not specify if you want to have multiple paths from sender to receiver?
Type of data?
I have a question.
Yes.
If you lose your connection to your switch, you cannot get information over your phone line, even if suppose you're using
If you lose your connection to your central office, yes, that's right. If the copper wires fail to work, what went away on 9/11 was not the COs, but the exchanges. Right? The area codes went away, not the central offices. So the reason you could still make a call is the copper wires. You know, I'm in Cobble Hill, right? The copper wire between my house and the local exchange continued to function. At which point I was on the network. If I needed to then go to 718, every device that knew that there was such a thing as 718 was melted at that point. I couldn't make a phone call. But I could, or 212 rather, I could make in 718 because the switch was never local. I could, however, get across the network in another way. What do I have to decouple if I want multiple ways to get across the network?
The route.
The address can no longer specify the route. Right? So the address is now not how to get there, but where it is. Right? And the route is handled differently. So the nodes in the network maintain something called a routing table. Okay? And what a routing table needs to know is roughly this. It needs to know how to do that. How do I move this message closer to where it is? That's all. It doesn't need to know how to deliver the message. Right? And there is never any point when a datagram, a chunk of data, moves across the internet, where any one machine knows everything about moving it from point A to point B. The only characteristic that any node that handles it is, can I get this closer to where it needs to go than it already is? Right. The effect of that is to move it. Right. So the first thing I know is, these are labeled by convention, class A, B, C, and D, the four quartets. Right. There's a class A network called 228. Right. It's coming from 198. How do I get it closer to 228? Now, in practice, routing tables sometimes have information down to class C, down to class B or C addresses. But the principle is just move it closer. And if the next node says, well, I can move it even closer than that, and the next node says, I can move it even closer than that, at some point it goes to the ITS server. And the ITS server says, hey, I have the entire class C address space for 228.222.151. I know where every one of those 256 machines is. When I deliver this closer, I can deliver it to the actual machine. Right? So this node is responsible for this bit, this final bit of address. The entire middle is just responsible for all this closer. The network we drew, day one of class, three subnets, routers between them. Right. What do the routers need to know? Or do what did a local node handed a message need to know?
If it's local or
global. Local or global, right? Yeah, I know how to deliver this or get rid of this thing. Right. This is not for me. Now the routers, because this is such a small network, couldn't go too far wrong. But if the networks have been labeled with some sort of header, right, before the address, then a router could say, okay, I know the subnet to get this thing. I don't have to know the address ASNI or BJF. Right, all I have to do is get it ABC. Right? So the network, if it maintains a routing table, and every node getting a message can essentially make an informed decision, I can get this closer. The address can happen without a route ever being specified anywhere. Right. So the major brittleness of the phone system
goes away. It goes away in this system. There is no, with the exception, the provisioning of the IP addresses has to remain unique. Like there's a, and all the class A namespaces in the world have been given out already. Unfortunately, they were given out to large companies in small countries. And there were only 256 of them. We're long since out of them. But in principle, nevertheless, they have to be unique, but they don't specify routes. In fact, there is no specified route anywhere on the network. As we remember from the network we actually stood up and built for credit card, what's the problem when there's no global awareness of routing? And there's no global awareness of the total address space? It's inefficient, but
messages keep spinning around.
Right. You can end up, if you've got a message that has nowhere to go, and every node's responsibility is only, I'm going to try and get this closer than it is. When does that message ever leave the network? Never, because nobody's job to get rid of messages if all the routing table has to say is closer. Right? And in particular, and you will sometimes see this if you do a trace route, you will get two nodes, each of which thinks the other is better able to get the message closer to its destination. And you'll see a message just start looping between two nodes. How do we get rid of those?
Timeouts.
A datagram, which is essentially a chunk of data, the smallest atomic chunk of data, has two things. It has an IP address and a time to live. Time to live is measured partly in seconds, it's measured partly in hop counts. I mean, it's measured in seconds, but there's also after 30 hop counts, things are typically dropped on the floor, which means,
right,
that you can traverse the entire internet and then some in significantly less than 30 hops. And by the time you're at 30 hops, that's considered pathologically bad and the message is deleted. The phone network is optimized to minimize the number of hops because analog amplifiers weren't able to have an unlimited number of sort of repetition. Because when you're dealing now with digital data, you can copy it perfectly endlessly. So this is now the basic unit of the message. Right? There's an IP address plus time to live. We didn't need a time to live on the phone call because there was no way that a phone message could propagate infinitely. And the system is either going to go through or it's not going to go through. All right. So this is now a datagram. This is not yet an application. Right? It's just a chunk of data. This is how a chunk of data moves to the network. Well, before I say, any questions about that? I want to call attention now away from the geeky details and towards the design philosophy. Of course, the phone is circuit switched, but then it's packet switched. Which means the network is only responsible for getting a chunk of data from here to there. Right? There's no point at which the route is completely specified or locked down. It's digital, which means it's endlessly perfectly copyable.
Is the perfectly copyable statement somewhat arguable?
One part of it, really. Their TCP fails at about one byte in a trillion. So
is that accounting for like packet loss though? I mean, essentially.
Packet loss is different from a failure to copy though. Packet loss, we'll talk about packet loss in a minute, but packet loss is a breakdown of higher order function. But the basic protocol of moving data hither and yon, a bit gets flipped. I said a byte before, a bit gets flipped about one in a trillion. So to a first approximation, the digital copying works well. The errors when they propagate the network come higher order, which we'll talk about in a bit. This is designed for generic transport. It's designed to move a set of bits from point A to point B The network has absolutely no idea what's going on. The entire phone network is optimized for phone calls. The internet is not optimized for anything except moving bits from hither to yon. The address is separated from the route. In fact, the route doesn't exist in a static form at all. The edges are the same thing as the middle. Let's say you wanted to build a network of a number of computers connected over Wi-Fi, but then connected to the larger internet. How would you do that? I want to build a Wi-Fi cloud in this room, and then I want to get an internet connection and have all of the computers that are connected to that Wi-Fi cloud be able to communicate out to the network. What's a device you can do that with?
Wireless router.
Wireless router. You can go down to JNR and buy a Linksys router. What else?
Use your machine as a router.
You can use your machine as a router. Every Mac, when you turn on sharing on a Mac, share this Ethernet connection via airport, share this airport connection via Ethernet. I've seen people do share this airport connection via phone line. That's a router. That's all a router is. Right? There's quantitative differences, right? The stuff Cisco makes works better and at higher scale than the stuff that Apple makes. But there's no philosophical difference between what those machines are capable of and the stuff that's in the basement of next door for ITS. Radically, radically different from the phone network. Right? It's as if Midori had a giant telco switch sitting on her desk that she would also answer. Right? So the whole thing is made of the same stuff. And the configurability and flexibility of the internet comes from that conceptual fact. As a result, and this is, I think, of everything about this comparison, this is the key. The network is dumb, and the terminal is smart. And that is such a radical shift that the bell heads, net heads, the two classes of engineers who work on these two systems, the bell heads were, and some of them remain, convinced that this is a bad idea, even as the internet is destroying phone network, which we'll talk about a little bit after the break. There's famous stories of AT&T, in fact, they may have been in the reading, the Abate reading, of AT&T engineers coming to look at packet switching demonstrations and saying, that will never work. Right? We recapitulated this argument, or pre-capitulated, I guess, this argument in the first class when we said, who orders the message, right? Who, this is a test versus a test, this is. Who's responsible for making sure that the message arrives in good working order? The answer on this side is the network is responsible. The phone has nothing to say or do about it. The answer on this side is the receiving node, the PC, laptop, whatever, is responsible for handling the message. All the internet is responsible for is getting it from point A to point B. It is up to point B to know. Any questions about that list of differences? Yes.
The time now, the difference between time now and network is kind of confusing for me.
The phone is a terminal. Midori. Midori's phone is a terminal. The network is everything that that MCI or Verizon runs. It is all the, in particular, is all the switches that are responsible for connecting a phone call. Midori's phone call is just an input and output device. Right? So I dial 1-212-998-1884. All of the intelligence of decoding those numbers and turning it into a phone call is in the network. Midori's phone does none of that except generate the numbers. Dumb terminal, the phone, smart network, Verizon, what Verizon runs. Over here, right, Midori's computer, which he sends an email address, is responsible for taking the email, packaging it up, subdividing it into a bunch of packets, labeling each packet, and sending it on. All the network does is move those packets from A to B. And there's not even one node responsible for that. At point B, they take all those packets, They say, oh, I'm supposed to do this with them. I'm supposed to feed them to the email application. Or I'm supposed to feed them to the web application. I'm going to reorder them. I'm going to check them for integrity, and I'm going to display them. Almost all the intelligence in message sending and receiving is in the computers at the edges. The middle is just about, oh, this goes here, that goes there, this goes here, that goes there. Smart terminal, done now.
Okay.
All right. So let's take a break.